call to order. It's 1:20 on April the 27th, and indeed, we have six items on the calendar. Present for the record, we have Representatives Gruenberg, Cott, Coghill, Dahlstrom, and myself, McGuire. We do have a quorum to conduct business. At 1:30, I have to leave for just 10 minutes to make sure the other body over there knows I'm serious about my bill that's up, and then I'll come right back.
I have to go then, too.
But what I thought we'd do is let's go ahead and get Mr. Fallharber out of the way, poor guy, and then we'll go to House Bill 269, then House Bill 268, then House Bill 276, then Senate Bill 36, then Senate Bill 140, then SJR 12. Okay? And so, without further ado, Mr. Fallharber, are you there?
Thank you.
My apologies. Boy, have we had a hard time connecting. You've been so patient with us.
Well, I think we've both been persistent, so that's a good sign.
Right. Well, the only thing I want to just send you with marching orders, if you don't mind, just to consider, is that over the past 3 years, with a fundamentally similar committee makeup, we've had people come through on these Board of Governors, Alaska Bar Association positions, and we've asked them to consider things and then never really heard back. So if you would just consider to us at your next meeting or whenever you get a chance bringing up some of the, I'm just going to throw out the things that we've asked in the past and see if you could make some kind of letter or something to us just to let us know that you brought it up and considered it and whether or not you intend to consider it further or not. So the first is some type of a graduated licensing fee for those that want to maintain their active license but who are not practicing in the private sector, if you will. So those folks who might be, I don't know, serving as the attorney for the Awake Shelter or other types of nonprofit activities. Just some thoughts about that.
At a reduced income, not the AGs.
Yes, at a reduced income. And so you could think about what that would be, but just the hardship that some folks have said about really wanting to serve in the nonprofit or in the servant sector, if you will, and then maintaining the expensive license. So that's that. That's the first part. And then the second part is some consideration about where we sit as number one in the nation for the highest bar exam fees, and what we could think about there. Are there some efficiencies we could build in? What's driving that cost to be so high? And the point is that, you know, when you come right out of law school and you've got all these debts hanging over your shoulder, and it's $1,000 out of the chute, and very, very high, high amount of money. The only other state that comes close is New York, and they've got a huge population. So we just kind of want to hear some thoughts about that, or I would like to at least hear some thoughts about that. And then is there anything else that members would like to add? And then we can send him on his way and... Is that everything we talked about? Okay, so.
Well, I have a couple of things.
Oh, Representative Gruenberg.
Mr. Fallharber, you remember, this is Max Gruenberg, you remember my question about continuing legal education and stuff like that?
Yes.
Mr. Fallharber, just.
Representative Guerra.
Just so you can hear the remainder of the dissatisfaction, and I know that Representative McGuire went through a bit of it. I guess I don't know how to say it all that less than bluntly, and I know this is not going at you, but I'd like you to carry this message really as you deliberate. You know, so far the state has let the Bar Association regulate itself, and there's the question of whether that's appropriate. And I sit here and I look at a few things. One is that I can relate from my own experience that I'm a non-practicing attorney because I don't make any money at it, so I've registered inactive. The only reason somebody registers inactive is so they don't have to worry about having to take the bar exam sometime later when they start paying their dues again. So for that privilege of not practicing law, I pay the Bar Association somewhere around $150 a year. And frankly, I sort of see it as almost extortion. You know, it's extortion for just so that I can not have to take the bar exam again when I start paying again. And I feel like I'm subsidizing those who are practicing law and making money, and I'd ask you to think about that, about how much you really feel like you can soak the members who don't practice. And then what Representative McGuire talked about was the other point, which is, you know, there, I've wanted to give volunteer legal advice. I've done it at the Brother Francis shelter before. And I certainly not making money as a lawyer anymore. I don't want to spend $600 a year to do that, because that's roughly the bar due, $500 or $600 a year. And the only way I can give free legal advice to people with no money without paying that $600 a year is if I do some very, very large amount of free legal work. And frankly, I think I should be able to do a modest amount of free legal work and not have to pay the $600 fee. So I would ask that you take a look at redoing the rule so that people are allowed to give free legal advice to people who have no money and remain inactive. As an inactive attorney, I can't do that now. All I can do is show up and say, boy, you really need a lawyer. And I think I should be able to do better than that. So those are my two huge gripes. I share them every single time somebody comes before this committee and never really hear back. So maybe my gripes aren't valid. I don't know.
Well, that if I could speak to that, we actually have spent a good deal of time trying to deal with that, and there are some concessions made to people who work only for Alaska Legal Services and who do a significant amount of pro bono. Your situation does slip through the cracks. And I'm something that would interest. I don't know if everybody in your committee is an attorney, but I wouldn't mind getting just a little feedback from you, because I'm sort of championing the thought of a balanced budget. And what I'm talking about is essentially there's three kinds of attorneys that could be forced, if you will, to pay for the cost of the Bar Association. That's yesterday's attorneys, today's attorneys, and tomorrow's attorneys. And if you remember that, it would be more than 10 years ago, there were some heroic individuals. Jeff Feldman was one, and Phil Volan was one. Anyway, they raised the bar dues very high at that time. I think it was 2.5 times what they were. With the thought that we would then have this carry forward sinking fund and wouldn't have to ask for a raise for a long time. And then actually their prediction was turned out to be overly conservative because of the Exxon Valdez situation, where we were able to charge out-of-state attorneys one-time fees for practicing. At any rate, my theory is, in a mandatory bar association, you kind of know you don't have a marketing issue for membership. And I think it makes sense to me, and there's you know, one other strong advocate that's a public member and a couple of attorneys, but it's not a very popular idea, surprisingly. I would like to see the bar dues change every year according to the budget. You just simplistically, you know, you could make your class of attorneys, as you suggested, but assuming one class for the sake of discussion, realizing that's overly simplistic, you just take the budget, divide it by the number of attorneys, and that's what your dues would be. It would keep the general membership more in the loop if they wanted to be, and, you know, from the standpoint of fairness, I think it's the only thing that's fair. But do you people have any thoughts on that?
Well, however, probably not unified thoughts, so I would probably, I guess, keep thinking it through. Though I would say you should probably charge the folks what they cost the Bar Association, and those of us who are inactive or retired, we don't cost you guys anything, and it seems costs us a lot of money just for the privilege of not costing you anything.
Do you realize that conflicts with the thought of a graduated fee for new members and a subsidized fee for license taking?
I certainly think that, and I can't speak for all the members here, I certainly think that you've got to balance your budget. I suppose you probably should think about something graduated for people who don't have a lot of money, the sort of brand new people, and But that's a policy call for you guys. I just certainly have a vibrant discussion on it.
And it, yeah, and it gets a lot of attention every year at budget time. And I apologize. I'm remiss. I will make it a note and will commit that you will get a report from, you know, either the staff or if we can't get a lot of cooperation there, which would surprise me because they are a wonderful staff. I would commit to writing you something myself.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions from the committee for Mr. Powell?
Thanks for agreeing to serve. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
If there are no other questions, then Representative Cott.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, I would move then that we forward the nomination of Joe
Fallhaber
to the full joint session for confirmation.
Good. Hearing no objection. Thanks, Joe. Your name will zoom on to the joint session and should be debated. Hopefully not too much debate when it's before the joint session, I think this week or next.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Okay, next we will go to, I know Representative Ramos is here, but respectfully we'll quickly go to Senate Bill 140 to ban internet spyware. Senator Terrell Staff is here. Dave is here to present that, and then I recognize, because we just heard Mr. Edelman in Labor and Commerce, that he is online from Massachusetts, from Harvard, and we'll hear him, and then we'll go to Mr. Representative Ramos's legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for this indulgence. Our expert witness is on the East Coast and has got a conflict coming up. Very quickly, so that he can get to his presentation, the purpose of Senate Bill 140 is to allow people in throughout Alaska, businesses and individuals, to have some recourse when they wish to take action against people who are otherwise putting things on and in their computers that they don't agree to or unaware of or cause damage. And Mr. Edelman will get into the particulars of the bill as it he is an expert and seen legislation throughout many states, is considered an expert witness by the courts, and has done extensive research and background on this. So without further ado, Mr. Chairman, I will just stand aside and let Mr. Edelman address the committee.
Hello, Benjamin.
Hello, thank you. Thanks so much for your flexibility given the schedule and complexities today. I'm going to be just especially brief in my opening remarks, but I'm happy to answer your questions at whatever length would be helpful, certainly. Any obligation I might have can wait for that. As the committee is aware, spyware has become quite a serious problem. There's a lot of software on a typical PC, maybe even on some of your PCs, that isn't there because you want it or because you asked for it, but rather it's there because some spyware company found a way to sneak it on and to make money from keeping it there. Some of these programs really do bona fide spying. They track your name, your email address, your credit card number, your purchases, and so forth. Others have a commercial purpose that might at first glance seem less nefarious, but that has actually proven to be quite a bit more profitable. They track what you do, and then they show you extra pop-up ads, often for competitors of the sites you ask for. It's this kind of spyware that today's bill seeks to focus on. Why focus here? Well, the outright spying, stealing credit card numbers and so forth, is largely illegal under existing law. If you're trafficking in someone's credit card numbers, you better believe that eventually the law is going to catch up with you and you're not going to like it. Surely there's a need for a more enforcement effort, but I don't get the sense that new legislation is really what's needed here. On the other hand, as to the advertising software, well, these programs are in an odd intermediate position. Some courts have said that what they do is illegal, but others have actually found it to be okay. They say it's a kind of competition somehow the web naturally creates. So there's a natural role for the legislature in stepping up and giving an answer, preventing the slow and costly litigation that has been present to date, and beginning to give consumers some relief from this unwanted software that at present has such overpowering economic incentives to sneak onto users' PCs. Just to be very concrete about what it is that we're talking about, you know, there's software that, for example, might notice you're going to an internet car rental site. They see you going to Hertz.com, and they say, huh, I bet he wants to rent a car. show you a pop-up ad for a different car rental site, maybe Budget.com, their competitor to Hertz. Well, maybe that's the kind of competition that might be thought to be fair or legitimate in the abstract, but the fact is you can make so much money by getting new Budget customers that way that it seems like 100 different companies want to be in this business of showing that kind of pop-up ad. It's the race to get onto your computer to trick you into clicking yes here or yes there or okay somewhere else that causes users' computers to get truly overwhelmed and clogged up with all the different programs and their respective pop-up ads. This bill comes in a very particular context with some legislation perhaps in the pipeline in D.C., and that, in principle, could preempt your state legislation, so you shouldn't be under any false illusions as to how long this will last. Fact is, Congress might act, and it would block your legislation altogether. On the other hand, they might remain paralyzed, as they have been for, what, the past 2 years that they've been talking about this in various modes. Similarly, there have been some bills passed in other states, though I think there's a lot we can learn from those bills, and as I see it, at least, their shortcomings. For example, a bill passed in California last year has a regular laundry list of different tactics that California says are impermissible. You shouldn't take over someone's computer and use it to send junk email. You shouldn't use someone's computer to install software and tell them that it's been removed when it hasn't. No lying. Well, so California gives a dozen odd different things that you shouldn't do, but oddly they omit the methods used by the most prevalent programs. They omit the sneaky installations, for example, and most importantly, they omit these pop-up ads that are the core of the profit motive of these programs. And there may nonetheless be some objections to this bill. Last year, when there was surprisingly similar legislation in Utah, I was really just shocked by how many technology companies actively spread disinformation about what the bill would do. They said it would ban antivirus software and porn filters, you name it. Of course, there was no legitimate basis for any of their allegations. My sense ended up being that software companies don't like the idea of governments, especially state governments, telling them how they can do business. Maybe we can see where they're coming from. After all, for the past 20 years, no one's really regulated software companies. They've gotten to do whatever they want. But we certainly have a great history of consumer protection legislation in this country, and that's entirely appropriate on the Internet, too. The Internet isn't free of laws just because it's implemented in software. Another possible objection to the bill is that it somehow grants excessive or undue protections to trademark holders, and that that creates some kind of constitutional problem, trademark being largely a federal concern. But as I read the bill, I don't think that's actually right. What the bill does is regulate unfair competition, not trademark, and it's fully within a state's rights to say that it is unfair competition to show ads in particular ways. That's just the kind of thing all kinds of unfair competition laws have been doing for decades. Finally, some folks will say that enforcement of the bill is impossible. They'll say it's hard to find these adware and spyware folks, and when you find them, you can't do anything to them. I emphatically disagree with that one. The folks making these pop-up ads are big companies. They have offices in New York and California. Some of them may be in Alaska, though I don't have any specifically in mind. They're easy to find, and there won't be any difficulty with enforcement or even with collection in due course. So I'll leave it at that, and I really am pleased to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thanks, Mr. Edelman. Are there any questions? And we'll keep them brief. Representative Guerra first, but because Representative Ramos will have to depart in 20 minutes. So go ahead, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Edelman, I had thought about this when I first saw the bill, and I just didn't know how we could enforce this constitutionally. And I just want to make sure that what I'm passing is actually meaningful. Without making this boring, tell me if you know the answer on this interstate commerce clause issue, because I've tried an internet bill last year, and there were very serious constitutional issues that we had to consider. In general, the interstate commerce clause says that we can regulate Alaskan companies, we can regulate people who know they're dealing with Alaskans. So, but we can't regulate people who don't know they're dealing with Alaskans. And most of these pop-up companies, I mean, I think they infect your computer without knowing where you live. And aren't isn't there some worry that the courts are going to say, we can't regulate companies who don't know that they're dealing with Alaskans under the Constitution?
Right.
Isn't that going to be a problem?
Thank you, Representative. I think you're absolutely right to be thinking about that important question. You have no legitimate basis at the state of Alaska to regulate, you know, a New York company doing business with someone in Massachusetts. No, you can't affect that. On the other hand, there are some very important reasons why this regulation of spyware is quite different from the typical internet regulation that states have talked about. You know, the canonical internet regulation is the state of Mississippi says, don't show that kind of porn in Mississippi, don't put it on a website. And there really is no way for the website to know whether a particular visitor looking for the sexually explicit images is in Mississippi or somewhere where the images might be permitted and welcome. And that's been the subject of quite a bit of litigation, ACLU versus Johnson and so forth, the canonical case there. This is very different from that, and let me be quite precise as to the ways in which it is different. One, the spyware knows where you are located. It does. Just as an empirical matter, these spyware companies are out there saying, we'll show your ad only to users in zip code 90210. We'll show your ad only to people in Hawaii. We'll show your ad only to people in the, you know, the 37th District of Texas. You can do that with spyware. They can figure out where you're located. How do they figure it out? It turns out it's not all that hard to figure out from a user's IP address. The user's IP address, just like a telephone area code, says a lot about where the user is almost certainly not going to be located. Furthermore, the bill speaks to this directly. If you turn to Section 2 of the bill, which is to be codified at 4545792B, and then it's 1, 2, and 3, well, you know, there's a lot of text there, but it's pretty simple, actually. It says, if the spyware company asks the user where the user is located and the user says Alaska, then just don't show these pop-up ads. And if you deduce where the user is probably located on a method that's sort of like the area code lookup, that's fine too. If the area code lookup method indicates the person is in Alaska, then don't show them the ad. So, as it turns out, for these reasons, you would have the idea that, you know, the programs actually can tell where a user is located. The final point to bear in mind here is that whereas the canonical internet cases are about web pages that are merely viewed, it's like, you know, looking at the web page, but the program, the web page never actually comes to reside on your computer in any permanent or tangible sense, that's not the case here either. Here, the advertising company is actually sending a program, a set of executable autonomous code. They're sending that to your computer, and the code is going to stay on your computer, live on your computer indefinitely. So the state of Alaska has quite a bit more nexus over that code, which has come to be physically present within the state of Alaska, than it does over a web page that's on a server somewhere else and merely gets copied into the state of Alaska from time to time as users view the web page. Finally, though, you know, you shouldn't take my word for it as to the constitutionality of any legislation. You have legislative counsel who should advise you on that important subject, and ultimately, if they say I'm wrong, then you better do what they tell you and not what I say.
Thank you, Benjamin. We appreciate it. Again, I listened to your testimony and appreciated the input and your knowledge on this issue in labor and commerce. We will be holding the bill, and I'll just let the sponsor's representative know that we'll, Representative McGuire has asked that we hold it, and we'll bring it back when she returns. And we're going to now move on to Representative Ramos's two pieces of legislation. And so we will move on to that. And if there are any other questions for Mr. Edelman, you can ask through the sponsor or call him directly. So now we have Representative Ramos and House Bill 269.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Which bill would you like me to begin with?
Whichever one you prefer. House Bill 269, looks like that's the first one on the agenda.
Okay. If you'll pardon me for reading, Mr. Chairman, it 269 is a little bit difficult for me to understand because it's...
Please, go ahead.
...legal in nature.
The record won't know you're reading.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Representative Jay Ramris. House Bill 269 deals with fixing the uncertainty caused by the U.S. Supreme Court's decision 2004 in Cooper Industries versus Avial Services. To paraphrase for a moment, I would suggest to you that this is the Blakely law, or the Blakely, it's the it's 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 the equivalent to the Blakely Law resolution that the legislature had to come up with when it comes to DEC cleanups. The U.S. Supreme Court found in the Avial decision that a responsible party who cleans up contaminated property cannot bring a contribution action against another potentially responsible party until such time as he or she has been sued by the state or federal government or has entered into a formal administrative settlement of liability. Alaska's hazardous substance remediation statutes are modeled after the Federal Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act of 1980, CERCLA, and the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act of 1986, SARA. Alaska's environmental cleanup statutes are modeled after these federal laws. The Avial decision puts into question the rights of Alaskans who conduct voluntary cleanups on properties contaminated by hazardous substances to undergo contribution actions against other potentially responsible parties. Voluntary cleanups of contaminated sites form vast majority of the environmental cleanups conducted in the state of Alaska. These voluntary cleanups allow the state to focus its limited resources on monitoring responsible party cleanup actions instead of undertaking costly administrative or judicial enforcement actions to force cleanups or undertaking cleanups at the public expense. The right to contribution actions against other potentially responsible parties creates an important incentive for voluntary remediations by allowing responsible parties to undertake effective cleanups themselves and then being able to recover some of those costs from other potentially responsible parties who fail to voluntarily undertake or assist with this remediation. The purpose of HB 269 is in response to the Avial decision. HB 269 will clarify language in AS 46.03.822J, thereby ensuring that responsible parties who conduct voluntary cleanups may bring contribution actions against other potentially responsible parties. HB 269 has the support of both the DEC and the Governor's Office. This is an area of law where Alaska cannot afford to have the common law decisions of the court outpace our codified laws. For these reasons stated above, I strongly urge the committee to support adopting HB 269.
Thanks, Representative. I see Ben Brown. Ben, do you want to testify from DEC, or do you want to just... Okay, sure. Why don't you come up, state your name for the record, then we'll get to Mr. Lyle, Tostevin, and Garby, or Garbs?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Benjamin Brown, the legislative liaison for the Department of Environmental Conservation. Larry Dietrich, the director of the Division of Spill Prevention and Response, would be a better person to have before you today, but he's otherwise occupied. DEC does support this bill. It's not a governor's bill, but we're very pleased to see Representative Ramirez take the initiative and introduce it. There isn't really a problem right now because of the Cooper Industries versus Avial decision, but there certainly could be one in the future if the state Supreme Court followed the lead of the U.S. Supreme Court and interpreted our mini CERCLA the way they interpreted the federal statute. And the end result, the worst case scenario would be that we would have to hail anyone into court that we thought was the main responsible party for an environmental situation just to get them to be able to seek contribution from other potentially responsible parties. Since we have a number of people who voluntarily undertake to do the lion's share of cleanup at some of these sites, we don't want to have our AAGs at the Department of Law drafting needless complaints and spending scarce resources on our time and on the, you know, on our part and on their part, when really most people know that they're going to be potentially on the hook and they want to get the process started of cleaning up a site and then be able to go after other parties. And Mr. Lyle will speak from an attorney's perspective about, I think, some of the clients that he represents and why this is important to them. And Mr. Tostevin, our drafter from the Attorney General's office, also, I think, can speak to it. So I'm happy to answer questions. But in short, DEC does support the legislation.
Okay, thanks, Ben. Any questions for DEC? Seeing none at this time, you can stand by, certainly. Okay, we'll go next to George Lyle. I notice he's marked down testify for questions, but do you have any comments, Mr. Lyle?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I appreciate the chance to talk to you today. My name is George Lyle. I'm an attorney with Gessen Rudd in Anchorage. I represent a number of private property owners who are experiencing the pleasure of contaminated property that was contaminated by people who owned the property before them or operated heating fuel systems on them or other various reasons that they, as the current owner, get stuck with the cleanup. This is a very real problem, and we do support this legislation, although Mr. Brown said it's a hypothetical problem in the future. I can tell you that at least one of my clients has had a significant settlement offer from another party withdrawn because of the Avial decision, with that party saying, we don't think you can bring a claim against us now because you're voluntarily cleaning this site up and have been cleaning it up for the last 10 years, and you therefore don't qualify to bring a contribution action against us. So this is a real issue with real consequences to generally my clients, the current property owners, who are the most easily targeted party for the cleanup. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I know Mr. Tossman's going to talk in more detail about the substance of the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Lyle? Seeing, hearing none, we'll go to Breck Tostevin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Breck Tostevin. I'm an assistant attorney general in the Department of Law. I represented the state in connection with oil and hazardous substance cleanups for the past 15 years now. As Ben Brown mentioned, the administration and DEC and the Department of Law support House Bill 269. The reason we support the bill is because it ensures Alaska's system for conducting environmental cleanups will continue as it has in the past, but without unnecessary additional costs, enforcement actions, or lawsuits. And the bill does this by clarifying the ability of persons who conduct voluntary cleanups to recover their costs from other responsible parties. And as many of you know, this right to recover costs from other liable parties is known as the right to contribution. And the bill ensures that the right of contribution exists even if the person conducting the cleanup hasn't been sued by the state or by persons forcing cleanup or to collect damages. House Bill 269 would remove uncertainty and confusion, which has been caused by the U.S. Supreme Court's recent decision in Cooper Industries versus Avial Services. And as has been mentioned before, in the Avial case, the U.S. Supreme Court found that under CERCLA, which is the federal statute upon which our cleanup statute is patterned, although ours is different in many respects, a responsible party could not bring a contribution action unless they had been sued by the state or federal government or entered into a formal administrative settlement with one of those governments. Now, this requirement of a lawsuit or a formal settlement with a state before a responsible party can bring a contribution action is not consistent with what the Alaska Supreme Court has interpreted with respect to our mini CERCLA statute. In the FDIC versus Laidlaw case, the Alaska Supreme Court recognized that responsible parties could bring a contribution action under 822 in the absence of a lawsuit by the state. The court reasoned that the legislature didn't intend the requirement of a lawsuit for parties to bring a contribution action. House Bill 269 would affirm the result in the Laidlaw case by allowing a contribution action, quote, after the issuance of a potential liability determination by DEC. And the bill defines what a potential liability determination is in Section 3, lines 6 through 16. And it does that in terms of DEC's existing practice. The determinations would include, for example, a letter notifying the person that the person is a potentially responsible party. In the practice, this is called a PRP letter, which is issued by DEC's Contaminated Sites Program. Another example would be a notice to the person of state interest in a release or a threatened release. DEC's Emergency Response Office issues these kind of letters in catastrophic spill situations from vessels and large land spills. And another example would be a request for site characterization or cleanup, which are issued by DEC's Contaminated Sites Program. If upon receiving a potential liability determination and the person conducts a voluntary cleanup, then that person would have contribution rights under 822J against other persons who are liable under the statute for that incident. So in sum, this bill would clarify these rights and they would encourage voluntary cleanups in the future. To do otherwise would really punish those who have already cleaned up property in the past and would reward recalcitrant parties who have failed to take action while others have spent money in their place. To talk a little bit about the current effects of this of the Abiol decision, it has caused great uncertainty and confusion, and has resulted in situations where people are afraid to step up and do a voluntary cleanup, and it's a kind of a created situation of chicken, and it really and unless you know have people coming to the state asking for us to sue them, and that's just really a needless exercise when you have people who are willing to voluntarily step up and clean up as long as they know they have the right to seek contribution against others. So I'd be happy to answer any other questions any of the committee members might have.
Thanks, Breck. Any questions? Once we're done, yeah. I don't see any questions. I appreciate your testimony, Mr. Tostevin. Oh, Representative Bureau has one.
Thanks. Breck, just one question. I just want to make sure, I want to hear your opinion. Is there are no unintended side effects of this bill that somehow might make it harder for somebody to recover from a responsible party? I don't see anything negative like that, but just assure me that there isn't anything like that.
Well, through the chair, Representative Guerra, no, there aren't any unintended consequences here. I mean, this bill is really just simply to clarify that right of contribution and recognize what the Alaska Supreme Court has already opined, kind of clear away the confusion.
And just one other question. So the only real worry, I mean, the Alaska Supreme Court's been clear. It's a state law, so that's binding. I guess the only real fear is that somehow the Alaska Supreme Court might in the future revisit its decision in light of what the United States Supreme Court did, and that's what this bill's trying to prevent.
Through the chair, Representative, that's exactly correct. You know, the concern would be that Alaska Supreme Court might revisit its ruling and change its mind in light of Abiol, but I personally don't think the Alaska Supreme Court is going to change its mind, but the problem here is it's created this uncertainty where people are afraid to step up to the plate and do cleanup. So by really fixing the legislation ahead of time, we're just going to prevent this, you know, uncertainty from hanging over our heads for a number of years.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, we'll go next. Thanks, Brett, to Christy Garby. Or Garbey?
Yes, this is Christy Garby, and I am testifying regarding House Bill 276.
Okay, yep. No, I see that she's on the wrong list then. Okay. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 269? Seeing, hearing none, nobody in the audience, no waves, so I'll close the public testimony. Is there any dialogue or discussion from the committee? Seeing, hearing none, then I'll take a motion. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House Bill number 269 with attached 20 physical notes and individual recommendations.
Hearing and seeing no objections, so moved. Thank you, Representative Ramros. Now we will go next to the other bill, House Bill 268.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm delighted to share with the committee that I don't need notes to explain the amended move-over bill. And if I may, if the committee will indulge me, I'd just like to share with you that the genesis for House Bill 268 was at a dinner I attended a few weeks ago in Fairbanks, put on by the Fairbanks Historical Association, where we honored Lieutenant Governor Jack Coghill. And while we were being regaled with remarkably colorful stories from the father of our esteemed majority leader, some of which would not pass the muster of his great moral conviction, and it was a delight to watch the majority leader squirm while these stories were being told. In the back of the room, I was sitting with the tow truck driver who was explaining to me the great peril and risk that tow truck drivers are subject to in non-police calls, particularly in Fairbanks in cold weather with ice fog, where we have broken down vehicles and tow trucks are there to assist or move stranded vehicles and motorists, and to provide some relief. And upon some research, we found out that about once a week across the country, a tow truck driver is killed, let alone those injuries that are suffered. And we also expanded the bill to include animal control vehicles. And we're familiar with those folks who have to rescue either stranded or dead stinky animals from the middle of the road. And so this bill seeks to amend the legislation already out there for a move-over bill and addresses tow trucks in the act of picking up a vehicle or animal control vehicles when they're either rescuing living animals or dead stinky ones.
Representative Ramos, do you have anyone online from the tow truck industry? I'm enraged at their fees, having been towed 2 years ago, and looking at the seven fees that they tacked on, and I would love to add that to this bill, but I see by the title I can't do that. But I would love to ask them about that. It's not relevant, but it would be a captive audience.
We can change that. Do whatever you like.
I won't change this bill. Do you have anyone online to testify that you're aware of? Because I don't have anyone on my list.
Nor do I, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify? Okay. With that definitive and assiduous detailed discussion on the bill, I'll close the public hearing portion. Any questions for the sponsor?
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question.
Yes,
Mr. Ramos.
Sir.
Is there a requirement now for tow trucks to have emergency lights?
Through the chair, Representative Cott, I believe so. I believe that all tow trucks are equipped with the same emergency hazard lights that vehicles are for elevated on their little mounted towing bracket package.
Mr. Chair, they're equipped, but are they required to use them?
Representative Ramos?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, I'm not an expert on tow trucks. My experience with tow trucks has been more along the lines of the chairman being on the receiving end of the.
Well, we could supplement that before. I wouldn't want to hold the bill for that.
No, absolutely not. And that was getting to my line of questioning, whether or not there was emergency lights on these vehicles, if they're equipped with them, or if they're mandated to have them, do they actually use them? Because this would only apply to those vehicles that have the emergency lights and they're actually flashing. Is that correct? And I guess the second line of questioning would be toward the animal collection guys that's indicated in the bill here, the animal control vehicles. Do they have, I just don't recall seeing any of those emergency lights. And did you have that same conversation with the animal control guys at the dinner?
Through the chair, Representative Codd, I'm showing my inexperience as a freshman legislature. Ought have been so thorough other than to recognize that standard parking lights at the very minimum are issued to these vehicles, and I assume that they are being implemented when a animal control vehicle is stopped on the side of the road. I do not know whether they blink.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I was another committee. I'm speaking kind of on behalf of Kayla, my wife, whom you know, who happened. No, she's in Juneau, but she's not here. She's on the Anchorage Animal Control Board. We affectionately call it the Animal Out of Control Board. Because if they're in control, you don't have to need the board. Anyway, I was wondering, the vehicle may be parked, but may not be, quote, removing an animal from the roadway, but it may be picking up an animal that's running around nearby or doing something else. And I'm wondering if the sponsor would have a problem, and instead of just limiting it to, quote, in the act of removing an animal from the roadway, stating that the animal control vehicle is performing official functions. That'd be a problem. Because I know animal control vehicles technically the animal may be not in the roadway, for example.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, first of all, I'm informed that animal control vehicles have strobes. And secondly, Representative Grunberg, we're very amenable to any amendment that you might offer that would improve the quality of this bill. So,
Representative Grunberg, before you make the motion, let's just talk about it. So it would state
performing official functions.
Okay. Do you want to make that that.
You could call it the lightning Dashka amendment.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so your conceptual amendment, he's moving conceptual amendment number one, and then if you could restate it for the record and for the committee.
Yeah, it would be deleting in on line 6 and 7 and 11 and 12 in the act of removing an animal from the roadway, just to delete that and state performing official functions.
Is there any objection or question? Okay, conceptual amendment number one is adopted. Are there any other questions or amendments? Representative Guerra?
Representative Ramirez, it's your best presentation of the year, by the way. Well, you didn't know that.
And it's been 20 minutes. Sorry for the delay in moving of your two bills. We've been much quicker, but we've dawdled.
Are we making this a crime? Or is this just a violation?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, we're recommending that it be a Class C felony if you don't move out of the way.
That is stinky. Seriously, is this a misdemeanor or is it a traffic violation?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I believe it would be a traffic violation. I believe I'm not familiar with. Is it? I would defer to.
It's a citation.
Vanessa Tondini, the legal counsel for Judiciary Committee, believes that it is would be under the traffic citation statutory purview, which I think the committee would be. I mean, all joking aside, I hope that's not a misdemeanor. Horrifying to get that violation.
I stand corrected. A defendant convicted of a Class A misdemeanor. So it'd be it would follow on in just because I don't want to get too silly about this. Frankly, it poses quite a risk for animal control folks and for tow truck drivers who really.
It's a Class A misdemeanor only if somebody is injured. Otherwise, it's an infraction.
That's a good call, that if someone's injured, your point is then you want it. Okay. Is there any dialogue or additional questions on that, Representative Guerra?
Are we sure about that, Representative Grunberg?
I'd ask Ms. Pearson. She's...
It's if you read sub-B...
Representative, or I mean...
Just sub-B addresses that of the statute.
Okay, so it's section 2835.185, overtaking and passing a parked emergency vehicle. That's the section we're amending, and as noted, section 2, subsection B, states a person who violates this section is guilty of, one, a Class A misdemeanor if personal injury results from the person's failure to vacate the lane or slow as required by this section, two, an infraction under circumstances other than an injury. So... I think that answers the question. Yes, if you hurt someone, and it's already in law. I mean, we're reading from current law. You're just adding tow truck and animal control.
I just, Mr. Chairman, just I'd like to go on the record saying it, that tow truck drivers perform a very important function for us, and they free up law enforcement to pursue many, many more serious, much more serious business out on the streets. And tow truck drivers are very important. Particularly in a cold climate like
this. Representative Olson has a question, but just to add that it is in your packet. You supplied that. You might have missed it. I think we all missed it, but he gave a copy of that statute section. Representative
Olson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me, Representative Ramirez, how that equals or if it's the same level of infraction as if a citizen hits a police officer or a firefighter in the line of duty under the exact same circumstances, but they're just not going after a dead or wild animal?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, I appreciate the question because that underlines my precise concern is that I think that the public, you know, through years of education and orientation from childhood on up, shows great deference to emergency vehicles just automatically. And I think that we don't show the same degree of deference to tow truck drivers or to animal control vehicles, and as a result, I think that those folks are at greater risk when they're out performing public good than public safety folks, because I think we're trained to move over away from them, and I want to accord the same safety, the opportunity to be safe in conducting their work.
Is there an amendment from the committee to add Western European and Asian non-English speaking tourists who are on the side of the road with their hazards on looking at moose and bear? Okay, no amendment.
But Mr. Chair, just help me, Representative Rammers, is there already an existing fine?
Watch it, Nancy!
I was rushing for my camera on my phone.
Where was the camera for that? I totally, for the record, I totally agree with what you're doing, and I think it's worthy. I just want to make sure that we're not going to have an infraction for something on this level, and even though we have ingrained that respect level for public safety vehicles, is there a legal charge against folks that ram into the back of the car and the police officer breaks their legs, getting smashed in between two cars while they're in the line of duty?
Through the chair, Representative Dahlstrom, I appreciate you wrapping yourself in the flag while asking that question, and I just find that that although we all accord public safety workers with a special amount of respect, as has been the subject of great debate in this building over the last few weeks, that these folks, these professionals, put themselves like any good citizen who stops to help a stranded motorist puts themselves at the same degree of risk when they stop on the side of the road. And I don't wish to draw a distinction in this case between public safety personnel and other trained professionals that stop at the side of the road when it comes to showing the common sense respect when a professional is trying to perform their duty to move over. You know, hence this is really another move over bill.
Representative Dahlstrom?
And I agree with you, but just help me out. Give me a yes or no answer. Is a police officer or fire official afforded the same protection? Would someone be charged with the same?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's in the statute.
Yes? Great. Yes. Thank you.
Law enforcement vehicles yes. Currently in law right now.
Yes, sir.
You're
yes,
just
Mr.
adding Chairman. Animal control and
Thank
tow
you.
Trucks.
Yes. Thank you.
I think there must be another section of law that deals with construction workers, is there not? Yeah, Mr. Pound's nodding his head, okay.
Representative Ramos is like, please don't make this a Christmas tree.
No. Okay. I think that's important.
Any other questions? Seeing, hearing none, Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the House Bill 268, Version A, with the adopted conceptual amendment number one. I'm not seeing a physical note. Is there one?
Yeah, 10.
With attached zero physical note and individual recommendations.
Seeing and hearing no objections, so moved.
Thank you to the committee, and thank you to Lieutenant Governor Coghill.
Isn't that great as the flag came out for Nancy while she talked? I mean, that really was neat.
I thought that was really great.
I was literally trying to get to my camera, but I saved you by grabbing the flag instead, so no picture.
One day the video camera's not here.
I know.
I thought you were going to be grabbing the flag.
I was
capturing it on film. Oh, that was great.
Peter Cott, Eagle River.
I'm wondering, you know, I haven't seen the fiscal note last bill. Maybe Representative Garrett can enlighten me, but it seems to me that there potentially could be a fiscal impact, because I would suspect that the division of licensing, the driver's license, folks will have to change their licensing manual, the manual they pass out. This is one of those areas that I would venture to say, after this becomes law, the common person on the street will not have a clue that we've got animal shelter vehicles in there. So I'm hoping that that particular provision will be included into the manual.
Well, I would only answer that Dwayne Bannock from Division of Motor Vehicles, my presumption is if he were here to testify, he would say that every year the booklet's reprinted, because every year the legislature changes some aspect, whether small minutiae or large part, and so that's reprinted every year, and I'm sure that's a cost absorbed. And I've never seen on any traffic violation change the fiscal note stating for the DMV manual to be changed. I mean, ever. But it's a good note that there will be a small cost to the change in the manual.
Ignorance of the law is not an excuse, Mr. Chairman. It could be a period of time in which the common Alaskan will not have any knowledge of them committing a violation of the traffic laws. Maybe an effective date should be coincided with the changing of the manual.
We should update that principle to to ignorance of the law is no excuse, but ignorance of a regulation.
It is. Well, this is intriguing enough. I'm willing to take an at ease and retire to Representative Grunberg's couch. I think we can all fit in there and just discuss it and mull it over.
Let's
no?
Roll.
Okay, we're going to go on then to House Bill 276, Representative Kant's business license tobacco endorsement.
This is more sexy than
this. It never ends.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Again, Representative McGuire's gone. She's a better chair than I, but we've moved three bills, so go ahead.
And I'll bring my trusty aide to the witness stand and give him an opportunity to present the bill. It's a pretty simple bill. Just does a couple major things.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Mike O'Hare, staff to Representative Pete Cutt. Before you this afternoon is HB 276, an act relating to business license endorsements for tobacco products, to holders of business licenses endorsements for tobacco products, and to the employees and agents of holders of business license endorsements for tobacco products. HB 276 addresses the amendment of current Alaska Statute AS 4370075 regarding the sale of tobacco products to minors. Basically, HB 276 increases financial penalties for non-compliance by employees and employers who sell tobacco products to minors. HB 276 removes automatic suspension of tobacco endorsement and increases the minimum fines for employers with education, monitoring, and enforcement programs on premises in place per violation from current levels of $300, $500, $1,000, and $2,500 to $750, $1,000, $2,500, and $3,500 per incident, respectively. HB 276 increases the minimum fines for employers without education, monitoring, and enforcement programs per violation from current levels of $300, $500, $1,000, $2,500 to $570, $750, $1,500, and $2,500, respectively, as well as having its tobacco endorsement suspended. HB 276 also makes an employee responsible for the sale of tobacco products to minors by imposing separate fines for those in violation. HB 276 allows qualifying employers, those employers with documented education, monitoring, and enforcement programs, to assert defenses and provide evidence at administrative hearings for endorsement suspension, regardless of the disposition of a case against the violating employee. Under current law, employers have little to no chance to present their own case if an employee pleads no contest or guilty to a violation. This should encourage more employers to create education, monitoring, and enforcement programs to prevent the sale of tobacco products to minors. HB 276 would require employees to sign a statement that they understand is against the law to sell tobacco to minors, and they will bear some of the responsibility personally if they violate the law. HB 276 creates a separate cause of action against the employee for selling tobacco to minors and imposing a fine of $300 to the employee. In a case of a disgruntled employee, this would be a sizable deterrent. We do need to continue to hold employers responsible to improve their own internal operations every day. We also need to put more responsibility on those employees who either refuse to participate in the education or intentionally violate the law. We must also recognize those responsible employers who do make strong internal efforts at curbing underage smoking in a fair, balanced, and reasonable manner. These changes could also make Alaska one of the strongest states in the country in terms of employer-sponsored education, monitoring, and enforcement programs, and lead to even better federal compliance. This concludes my introduction. I believe we do have some people present online to testify and share some firsthand knowledge and experience with you. I believe Diane Casto, the Project Manager for Prevention and Early Intervention from the Department of Health and Social Services, is with us. And she's here to discuss her concerns of the and the current program. And I think we also have some members online, Steve Rush from Holiday Companies, Mike Ellerding from Northern Sales, to testify as well.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Questions for the bill's sponsors, Representative? Representative Guerra.
A couple questions. Just tell me if I have the summary right on these two points. Right now, a tobacco seller can lose their endorsement for a violation and they won't be able to anymore, or will they still be able to under some circumstances?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, those, it's my understanding that those employers that do have these enforcement education programs in place and are documented to do so, the HB 276 removes that automatic suspension but increases the fines. Sir.
Just the compare, and just so I have it clear in my mind, compare what's the law now, how you can lose an endorsement now, and then under this bill, what you would have to do to lose an endorsement under this bill.
I think I'd like to, through the chair, have Diane answer that question, please.
Okay. Let's go to the folks online. Just due to the lateness of the hour, I just ask, I've got a little 3-minute timer. I'm going to try to ask you to stick to that if you don't mind, so that we can get to the other three bills on our schedule today. So, without further ado, Cynthia Drinkwater is with the Department of Law. Ms. Drinkwater, are you there?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Cynthia Drinkwater, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Commercial and Fair Business section of the Department of Law. And I represent the Division of Occupational Licensing in Tobacco Endorsement Matters. Given the time limit, I will shorten my remarks, and I will start off, since it, I think this will respond to the question posed by Representative Guerra. I wanted to just take a moment to describe the current statutory framework for tobacco endorsements and how AS4370075 operates. Basically, there's a very strong incentive now for employers or vendors of tobacco products in Alaska to be very vigilant in the hiring, training, and monitoring of their employees who sell tobacco, because under the current framework, if the holder of the tobacco endorsement is convicted of selling to a minor, or if the employees or agents, while acting within the scope of employment or agency, are convicted of selling to minors, then there is liability on the holder of the endorsement, and there are mandatory stepped penalties, starting with a 20-day suspension and a $300 fine, and if there is a second conviction within a 2-year period, the fine is $500 and a 45-day suspension, and it goes up from there. Of course, once a holder of the endorsement receives a notice of suspension, if there's been a conviction, then there is an appeal process. But the legislature in 2001 made this a fairly limited process. The issues at the hearing are limited. And the legislative intent at the time was to create a framework of penalties where the outcome was known, was determinate, and would not require lengthy hearings. There was also consideration that the sanctions that were imposed, in being both civil penalties and suspension periods, would essentially level the playing field for different types of vendors. In other words, for kind of the smaller mom-and-pop type operations where they're not doing a high volume of business in terms of tobacco sales, the fine is going to be what's really going to get their attention, whereas the suspension may not really be that important to them. In contrast, for the...
Are you there, Ms. Drinkwater? Ms. Drinkwater? You cut out, or maybe hit the mute button? Okay. Whenever she comes back online, I guess let me know.
Madam Chair, you're 3 minutes.
Yes, I love it.
You've lost.
I love it. Okay, so next I'll go to Christy Garb or Garby with the American Lung Association. Ms. Garby, are you there? Are we having problems with teleconferencing?
Again.
Okay. So is there anybody here in the audience? Oh, good. Diane Casto? Welcome to House Judiciary.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Diane Casto. I am the Manager for Prevention and Early Intervention Services within the Division of Behavioral Health, Department of Health and Social Services. And I'm here today to discuss our opposition to HB 276 for a number of reasons, two primary reasons. The first reason being, well, actually, let me start. Let me backtrack and just tell you a little bit about what I do and where this program fits into the whole Department of Health and Social Services. The Tobacco Enforcement and Education Program is part of the Division of Behavioral Health within Prevention Services. This program used to be part of Public Health, but after a reorganization 2 years ago, it came over to the Division of Behavioral Health. And the reason it came over to that portion of the tobacco program came to Behavioral Health is that the sell rates of tobacco products to youth are directly linked to our federal Substance Abuse Prevention and Treatment Block Grant through the SINAR legislation, which is federal legislation. So I will talk about that in just a minute. The two primary reasons that our department is opposes this bill is that, first and foremost, one of our main goals is to promote healthy youth in the state of Alaska, and obviously smoking is a huge problem. All tobacco products are a problem for youth in the state of Alaska, and we believe that the current system that we have, and the one that Ms. Drinkwater was just about to explain to you, and the system that is currently in place, has been very effective in reducing access to tobacco products by our youth. So we hope to continue the great progress that we have made. If you will look to my left, we do have one of our nice large posters for you to look at, and I hate to use a cliche, but in our mind, a picture speaks a thousand words. And the mandatory suspension of tobacco endorsements began in July of 01, which was the beginning of fiscal year 02. And in prior to fiscal year 03, we had always been in violation of the federal 20% sell rate for youth. And in 2003, after a full year of the new regulation, we went down to a 10% sell rate for youth, which put us below, at that time, the national sell rate average. Last year, we don't have our 2004 numbers up there. We increased just a little bit, but it was a fairly insignificant, up to almost 12% was our sell rate. I know we're on limited time, but if anyone has any questions about the SINAR process or how all of that works, I'd be happy to answer those.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. When you say sell rate, that's the number of vendors who at some point have violated the law, or is that the amount of cigarettes that are going to minors?
Well, let me give you just a brief overview. The way we do the SINAR survey is, again, it's a federal requirement of our block grant. The SINAR survey is done between May and September each year, and it is a process where we take all of the businesses that have a business license with a tobacco endorsement that are accessible to youth. So we take all the bars out and you know, places where youth are not allowed, and we take that number, and then we have to do a random sample poll to get a valid sample of businesses. I think last year our sample, by the time we got throughout the ones who were no longer in business, was just under 400 businesses. And then during the months of May through September, we go out with an adult investigator, tobacco investigator, an employee of our department, and they take with them two confidential informants, which are youth, and you'll see that's also listed on the bottom. Our confidential informants range from age 15 to 18 years of age, mostly 15, 16, 17, because 18, they're starting to look a little older. And we're not in the business of trying to trick people. We want this to be honest sell attempts. So they go out to all the communities and to the businesses that have been selected through this random sample, and the CIs attempt to buy cigarettes. If they are, if they complete a sell, they go into the sell rate. So last year we had about 12% sales of the almost 400 businesses.
You do one attempted buy at each place?
Yes, just one attempted buy at each business that was pulled for the SINAR sample.
Okay. Further questions for Ms. Castro?
Actually, I got a couple.
Wrapping up.
Okay, very quickly. So again, I think that what we know is that once the mandatory suspension of the tobacco endorsement went into place, our rates dropped significantly. And we believe the reason they dropped significantly was because of the consequence of losing your tobacco endorsement, which can cost businesses quite a lot of money, much more than a fine. And the fines were not successful in keeping the sell rate down. In addition to that, we also, in this same period of time, have significantly reduced our overall smoking among youth. In 1995, we had a 37% rate of smoking among our youth, our high school age youth. In 2003, we were down to 19%, lower than the national rate, which, as you all know, in social services, we're always on the top. So we feel very of our youth, and we believe that the suspension is a great part of that. I have brought, because we also do tobacco vendor education, we are available anytime. I've brought packets if anyone would like those. I'm here to share them.
Yeah, okay. We would. Okay. Vanessa can pass. Representative Coghill.
Chair, I think probably one of the purposes of this bill, and I'm chewing on it myself, and maybe I'd ask the department to help me understand. There are some places where the fine probably could be handled. There are some places where they'd be put out of business if their license is suspended. I mean, there's some places that probably don't care if their license is suspended. I would think of places where they're departmental type stores, probably no big deal to them. Maybe they're a gas station and really they're selling more pop and gas and cigarettes as a convenience. If you get into a place where tobacco might be their primary industry, and then you have one bad actor as far as a an individual in there, you put the whole place out of business. So I could understand why the fine might be there. But what is the individual responsibility, not of just the business, but of the individual actually selling?
Through the chair. We believe it's a mutual responsibility. You know, obviously, it is a responsibility of the employee to not sell. And I think that through education, vendor education, if our retailers are providing the vendor education, as was pointed out in the introduction of this bill, that they do have responsibility and they should not be selling. And there is a fine both for the employee and the employer, as well as the tobacco suspension.
Other questions? Thank you, Ms. Castro.
Thank you.
Okay, we are back online, and so I'm just going to go through, and again, everybody, you've got 3 minutes. My apologies, but it's just that time of the year. So, and please feel free to supplement your testimony with any written documents or anything you think we'd need, and the fax number here is 465-6592. Okay, so next on the list I have Christy Garby. Christy, are you there? Ms. Garvey?
Yes, I am here. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Great. Madam Chairman and fellow committee members, this is Christy Garvey, and I'm Director of the American Lung Association of Alaska. I'm testifying today on behalf of Alaskans for Tobacco-Free Kids, an alliance comprised of a number of health-focused nonprofits. Alaskans for Tobacco-Free Kids opposes House Bill 276 as it will effectively weaken the enforcement component, which is a cornerstone of our statewide comprehensive tobacco control program. This legislation truly strikes at the heart of our efforts to deter kids from smoking. Alaskans for Tobacco-Free Kids reminds the committee of the amazing progress made in the reduction of youth tobacco use as measured by the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, which shows a 50% reduction in cigarette smoking among Alaska high school students from 95 to 2003. Another YRBS statistic shows that Alaska students who reported purchasing cigarettes at a store also dropped 50% from 95 to 2003. This legislation would, for all practical purposes, eliminate the ability to take away vendors' rights to sell tobacco. Without this, there is no financial incentive on the part of the vendor, the parties profiting from the sale of tobacco, to comply. In fact, history shows us that suspension has been necessary. companies who hold the privilege of a license to sell tobacco, which is illegal, yet deadly and addictive product, also must bear the serious responsibility for the sales of this product to our children. The company is the entity making the profit from the sales of tobacco, and therefore it is the company who must bear the responsibility to hire capable, responsible, trainable, competent employees who follow the policy of not selling tobacco to those under age 19. It just doesn't seem that difficult a rule for management to train employees to follow. Please do not fix something that is not broken. This proposal is a giant step backwards in our efforts to prevent youth tobacco addiction. The current law has effectively done the job of reducing sales of tobacco to youth and therefore does not need any further changes. I thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much. Ms. Garby, questions? Representative Gira.
Ms. Garby, I don't know if this is for you. It's really for anybody who knows the answer. Under the bill, how does it change the ability to lose your endorsement? How would you lose your endorsement under the bill? Why is it so much harder to lose your endorsement?
Through the chair, to Representative Guerra, I'm not certain I am the person to answer this question. I'll take one crack at it quickly and then defer. But my understanding is that it would be vendors would have the ability to put in place an educational program of some sort that they consider to be adequate, and once they have done that, then they are basically going to be immune from suspension.
Thanks, and we'll see if anybody else has a different comment, but I appreciate it.
Sure.
Okay, next we will go to Mike Ellerding. Mr. Ellerding, are you there?
Yes, I am, Madam Chairman. Good afternoon, committee members. Thank you for allowing me to testify. My name is Mike Ellerding from Northern Sales Company. And on behalf of the local tobacco industry in Alaska, we support HB 276. We think it's good legislation, and it corrects a deficiency in current law while continuing to provide the state enforcement officials with powerful tools necessary to assist them in keeping tobacco out of the kids, out of the hands of children. The bottom line is really keeping tobacco out of the hands of kids, and we think that Alaska retailers, in partnership with the state, are doing a good job. Results of the CINAHR surveys conducted by the state indicate the state has made huge progress in becoming and remaining compliant with federal guidelines. In fact, nationally, Alaska ranks in the top one-third of all states for CINAHR scores in 2003 and 2004. HB 276 continues to provide the state with tools to penalize non-conforming retailers while not unjustly punishing retailers who are doing everything within their powers to comply with the state law. The problem with the current state law is that the penalty phase does not distinguish between different retail classifications or the size of a retail operation. As a consequence, the penalty for a violation of state law prohibiting the sale of cigarettes to a minor impacts different businesses differently, just as Cynthia Drinkwater indicated. For example, we have a small outboard repair shop in Ketchikan that sells 1 to 2 packs of cigarettes a week. We also have a large grocery store that sells hundreds of cartons per week. On the first offense for a violation of selling cigarettes to a minor, there is a 20-day suspension for the retailer's tobacco endorsement, as well as financial penalties. The problem is that the 20-day license suspension for the grocery store selling hundreds of cartons is much more severe penalty than the 20-day license suspension for the outboard repair shop, hardly selling any. And in some cases where you have a tobacco shop or a smoke shop and their only product is tobacco, the mandatory license suspension effectively closes the shop down in comparison to the outboard repair shop, where there's a negligible effect because they're still going to do their outboard repairs. Under current state law, the license suspensions are mandatory and do not take into account mitigating circumstances. For example, whether or not a retailer has a training program that instructs its clerks to check IDs effectively and increases the clerk's awareness of the law prohibiting the state the sale of tobacco to minors. House Bill 276 changes the license suspension phase of the state law and continues to provide the Department of Health and Social Services with the right to impose license suspensions, but only after initiating a proceeding to examine the retailer's efforts to comply with state laws regarding the prohibition of tobacco sales to minors. The change is significant because it provides the retailer with an affirmative defense for those retailers who have an effective training program, and it provides them an opportunity to have a hearing before the imposition of a license suspension. We support HB 276 and would like to see the committee pass this bill, out. There is a technical amendment we'd like to add to this committee regarding the tobacco stamp bill. Department of Revenue has reviewed the amendment, and I do not believe they have any objection to the amendment, and it is complementary to this bill. This concludes my testimony. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ellerding. Representative Cott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ellerding, you mentioned there was a technical amendment. Do you have that available for the committee, or have you forwarded it to the committee? I haven't seen any amendments that have been brought forward on this bill, but if it's something you can briefly explain, maybe the chair would give you the liberty to explain it.
I can briefly explain it, if permission with the chair.
Absolutely, Mr. Ellerding.
Right now, Alaska law, this is regarding the Alaska Stamping Act. Alaska requires that 80% of all the cigarette stamps be on each pack. Technologically, that's not possible. The equipment isn't able to do that. What we have achieved in terms of compliance with putting a stamp on a carton of cigarette or pack of cigarettes is like the 55% level. Department of Revenue, in partnership with wholesalers who are stamping, has requested that the stamping compliant requirement go from 80% down to the 55%. That's the amendment that we'd like to attach to this bill.
And Madam Chair,
thank you,
Representative Anderson.
This is a great segue for me to not only ask for Mike's, confirmation of this, but Mike, you are in competition with, but also in association, I think, in support of this legislation and the amendment, even though the company doesn't have a representative online, with Jan's Distributing and the Scotts and those folks. Isn't that correct?
Chairman, Mr. Representative Anderson, yeah, that is correct. Jan's Distributing, Frontier Expediters, the entire Alaska wholesale distribution community is in support of this bill. Does correct the deficiency that currently exists.
Thanks, Mike. And the only reason I asked that first in preface is to make note that the committee understands this. Secondly, then a statement. Over the summer, Bob Scott, who owns Jan's Distributing, another distributor of tobacco products, Snapple, beef jerky, I mean, you name it for the mom and pops and smaller gas stations, they had me come in as a result of this legislation in June, during the election, actually, and they said, could you come in, and both live in my district in East Anchorage, but have a plant or a operation by the airport. They said, can you come to our warehouse? And we want to show you something. We just purchased a bunch of cartons of cigarettes, and we have this new, the legislature had passed the new stamping requirement, and of course it's difficult for them having to pay for one or two more employees or more, and Mike can speak to that, and the burdensome nature of that. Granted, we passed the tobacco stamping procedure and process and mandated it, but it's difficult for that. Equipment is expensive, and ultimately I think they subcontracted out, but they didn't have any recourse, and there was often inadvertent packets packages in the cartons that were missed. And briefly, he opened a couple new cartons that he had just purchased, and he said, take a look in at the cigarette. What are they called? Package.
Packs.
Yeah, I don't pack. And so they, I'm sorry, I couldn't think of the word. And so we were looking, and he said, notice. And I looked, and there was one pack with a stamp, one pack with a stamp on the side, one pack with a stamp half, one pack with a no stamp. And he said, this is what he faces every time he gets a new carton and box, and however you want to phrase that, the shipping method. And is this accurate, that this happens often, and why you want that amendment? Because I was shocked. And he said that he can be fined and in trouble, and he says it's ultimately really burdensome. And I know that you're not asking to repeal that. I think you're just reducing the amount that you can get fined on. But is that an accurate hypothetical, in this case, reality?
Representative Anderson, through the chair, the manufacturer sold the state and the tobacco stampers a little bit of a bill of goods in when they originally came to the state and said we can do 80%. That was their technical specifications. They said the machines and the equipment would be able to do 80%. In reality, that hasn't been the case. And as we are just new in the stamping field, there was a number of trial and error and hit and misses that occurred. But over time, we have gotten better, and if you talk to Mr. Scott right now, I think he'll find this a little bit better. But it still is a very important issue, because if there is less than 80% of a stamp on any pack of cigarettes, that pack of cigarettes is subject to forfeiture, There is a fine that's imposed on the person who possesses it. In addition, the person who possesses it also has to pay the tax. So it is a situation that needs to be addressed, and we have been working with the Department of Revenue, and the amendment that we've crafted here would address that, and we think it would tie in nicely with HB 276, which we also believe is very important and good legislation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ellerding. Next, I'm going to go to Steve Rush, and then Dan Riley, and then that's all I have. Mr. Rush, are you there?
Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Steve Rush, and I represent Holiday Station Stores. We own and operate approximately 30 convenience stores in the state, employing over 300 Alaskans. And I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill 276. We at Holiday believe the bill should be enacted for a number of very important reasons. The bill's sponsor really did, I think, a wonderful job and a very thorough job of going through those. I'll highlight a few points, and I know there are issues of certain concern that I will try to address on the way, but I'd like to save time, too, if anyone has any questions. First, there is no doubt that this bill substantially stiffens the penalties for selling tobacco to minors.
Look out.
We at Holiday do business in approximately 15 other states, and I have not seen a state that has fines of this significant nature. Alaska will literally be the highest that I've ever encountered. Secondly, the bill recognizes and encourages employers to implement the education, monitoring, and enforcement programs that have already been alluded to. Right now, under the current state of the law, there's very little incentive for an employer to behave responsibly as opposed to doing little or nothing to educate and train your employees, because everyone is essentially treated the same. You could have the most sophisticated educational system and training program for your employees, but if you are fined for a first offense, you face a 20-day suspension, the same as an employer who does virtually nothing to train their employees regarding sale of age-restricted products. We at Holiday have a very comprehensive, proprietary, computer-based training program that we've put together to educate and train our employees to not sell tobacco to individuals who appear to be under 31 years of age, and we're quite proud of that program. But under the current state of the law, our efforts at curbing tobacco purchases by minors is not rewarded at all, and we're simply treated like an employer who does virtually nothing. Third, the bill would establish a more predictable and fair due process for employers. I listened to Ms. Drinkwater's testimony, and she's right. It does provide a very streamlined administrative process for going after a license holder, but essentially, you have no defense when you show up. If the employee sold tobacco to a minor and pled guilty or no contest, you as the employer are strictly liable. That's really all that the hearing consists of. The evidence is introduced that the fact that the employee was cited, and the administrative officer basically then says that the case is over, and you as the employer pay the fine and face the 20-day suspension. We don't believe that's fair. We believe we should be able to offer all the efforts that we have done to prevent sale of cigarettes to minors, including our educational and training programs. And that's what the law really needs to be corrected on. Fourth, the bill would encourage employees, to be more diligent in checking ID when selling tobacco. It creates a civil penalty for the employee who sells the tobacco to a minor, and the employee would be required to sign a statement that they understand that it's against the law to sell tobacco to minors, and they bear some of the responsibility if they violate the law. Finally, I was cut off for a brief period of time, but there has been some concern that removal of the suspension provision may increase the non-compliance or failure rate for purposes of SINAR funding. As you know, that the state receives money from the Department of Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, giving the state of Alaska as well as other states money to fund alcohol, drug, and mental health treatment programs. The concern being that if this suspension provision is changed to allow an employer to have a defense, that the SINAR noncompliance rate will go up. And if it increases more than 20%, then it can affect state funding or receipt of federal funds. But that is not borne out by the empirical evidence in other states, and I'll point you to three specific states. California, for a first offense, only fines an employer license holder $200 to $300. Their 2004 SINAR compliance rate was well below 20% at 12.2. Looking at two other states on the Western Seaboard, Oregon fines a license holder $100, but yet has a CINAHR compliance rate for 2004 under the 20 percentile figure. Oregon came in at 16.3%. And finally, Washington, for a first offense, they would fine $100. And their CINAHR compliance rate in 2004 was excellent at 10.8. So removal of the suspension provisions has absolutely no link to what the enforcement rate is or non-compliance rate for purposes of CINAHR funding, and I don't believe that that should be considered a significant issue when weighing House Bill 276. We at Holiday really do appreciate the opportunity to present these facts before your committee and would ask that you pass House Bill 276, and I would be more than happy to respond to any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Rush. Questions? Okay, hearing none, final person to testify is Dan Riley. Mr. Riley, are you there?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Riley. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for Tesoro Refining and Marketing Company, and I'm here today to testify in support of HB 276. I will be brief. Tesoro operates 32 convenience stores in Alaska, and Tesoro is a strong advocate in the prevention of selling tobacco products to minors. We have training programs in place to ensure our employees are aware of their responsibilities not to sell tobacco products to minors. All of our convenience store employees are required to complete a new employee orientation when they are hired. That employee orientation program contains a section on techniques for alcohol management and specific lessons on restricted products. The training covers in detail procedures regarding the sale of restricted products, and employees are required to pass a validation test with a score of 100% at the conclusion of their training. As many of you know, Tesoro started out in Alaska. We now operate convenience stores in 16 states across the western United States. I can tell you that Alaska is the most stringent regarding tobacco sales laws of any of the states that we operate in. The proposed bill before you will allow Alaska to continue to have the toughest penalties of any state, and it will assure that Alaska is the country's leader in terms of employee-sponsored education, monitoring, and enforcement programs. Tesoro supports the provisions that stiffen penalties for noncompliance. We also support the provision that will allow employers with aggressive internal education and monitoring and enforcement programs, like we believe we have, to take credit for those programs as mitigating factors in administrative hearings. We believe the bill establishes a more predictable and fair due process and encourages employees to be more diligent in checking IDs at the point of sale. I respectfully request that you support HB 276, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions? Okay, is there anybody else here in the audience that I've overlooked that wishes to testify? Is there anybody else online wishing to testify on House Bill number 276? Okay, hearing none, I'm going to go ahead and set House Bill 276 to the side and bring up Senate Bill number 140. Internet spyware.
Done. We did that the other day.
We did that, Madam Chair. We're ready for a
move
vote.
Already?
Oh, my. No, I'm sorry. It was just
we're ready for a vote.
We're
ready for a vote, Madam Chair. We took the testimony from the person online.
Okay.
Because
but you're ready for a vote.
We have accommodated their schedule, but they were back in.
Fantastic. Right, so, were. Okay. So Senate Bill 140, is there further testimony from the committee, discussion, amendments?
Madam Chair, it's a good bill. We've heard Labor and Commerce seems to be, and Representative Guerra certainly makes a good point when you're dealing with internet transactions or just, you know, complications with the internet in and of itself because of the nature of the beast, but I think we're okay on this one. So I would support moving the bill out.
Okay. So
before he makes a motion, I haven't had a chance to go through it here, and I'm not going to stop it. But
yeah,
there are licensing things that I think our department has talked to us about where you actually are inadvertently tricked into accepting some spyware. And I don't know if that's addressed in here, too. And I'll go talk. He's my senator, so I'm going to go talk to him. But in my reading through it, I didn't get the level of comfort that I normally would want to get on it. So I'm going to do some research on it beyond that. Certainly, you have to actually agree to those licenses. So I understand some of it's a responsibility of those clicking on. But there are some really interesting hidden things that you agree to.
Right.
And you know, I guess I'd probably more set to a licensing bill than it would be a spyware bill. It crosses over because they are spyware that you actually agree to. So with that on the record, I will chase down the sponsor, find out if that's something else that they're going to deal with along the way.
Further discussion, Representative Gruenberg?
I apologize. I had to go deal with the cop in the neighborhood bill over in CNRA committee. I didn't hear any testimony about this. I don't know anything about the bill.
Excuse me. I don't know what to tell you. Do you want me to?
No, if somebody could say in 25 words or less what this thing does.
Do you want to take a shot at it?
I don't want to delay the bill. I just don't know anything about this. I don't like the pop-up ads. I know that. Pardon me?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Gruenberg, this bill is carefully modeled after states. 10 states have done this. Utah's model is the one we followed most closely. This bill is aimed directly at companies who violate fair trade practices by commercially inserting information into your computer. You go to a Hertz website, you see a budget ad. It's becoming a huge business because with the spyware in your computer that you may or may not know is there, and Curtis Clothier behind me will tell you that they swept our computers here within the last 24 hours, 685 pieces of spyware on our legislative computers alone. And so what this does is it allows civil procedure from a person or a business to go into court when they've been aggrieved, and it also allows the Attorney General under existing fair trade practice statutes, we haven't changed any of that, we've been very careful not to affect the good spyware. In other words, Dell computer can put spyware on to alert you when problems are having, and we have asked to make sure that the bill, and we have a memo to that effect, does not violate the Commerce Clause by assuring that any actions taken will be by people who are here in Alaska, who own their computers here, and the identification process, as explained earlier in testimony, is one that is straightforward.
Okay, is there a motion?
So may I just ask
Representative Gruenberg?
So this gets at those little ads that pop up.
This addresses the ones that have been put into your computer, sometimes without your knowledge, sometimes through cleverly written agreements. Sometimes a teenager may see a solicitation come on the screen and click on it. They may open their computer up to go to instant messaging or trade music. And when you open a computer line up with another computer, you also open it up to. So these are invasions, but they're not from people overseas and in faraway places. They're from major companies that have made a business out of preempting what normally would be fair trade and practice.
Okay.
Madam Chair, that was 361 words. So I told you couldn't do it in 25 words.
Representative Anderson.
Seeing no other questions, amendments, offers, I move Senate Bill 140 out of committee with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Zero fiscal
Zero.
Notes. Okay, is there an objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill 140 moves. That brings us next to Senate Bill 36. And we have the bill's sponsors, Representative Mr. Stancliffe.
Thank you very much. Once again, Dave Stancliffe, aide to Senator Terrio. Appreciate the time on this. I know Representative Gruenberg helped us with this in the previous committee, added some comfort language with regard to being able to use family and people you trust to get your absentee ballot to the Division of Elections or into the mail. Madam Chairman, last year there were some procedures that happened between people who were applying for absentee ballots in the Division of Elections without pointing any fingers. Some of those irregularities included holding ballots, changing ballots, ballot forms that weren't private so that when they went through the mail, some of the information that was provided on them was public. Ballots that were changed or applications for ballots that were changed after they had been signed. And also, I guess pr- probably the most serious of all of those would have been the ones that where there was just an obvious error omitted or information omitted, and they amended it after the person had signed it, saying under penalty of law that everything was true and correct. The other part of it that was a little disconcerting was that some of the application forms were made up to request information that the Division of Elections didn't need, didn't want, and doesn't require. So this bill simply allows the division to authorize the form that's going to be used to ensure that none of those things happen, and that there's a direct route between the application person and the division. Representative Gruenberg correctly discovered that that might preempt your wife or your son or your daughter or your friend taking it to the post office for you or the division, hence the intent language that was put in the previous committee. This bill had has had widespread bipartisan support. I only mention that because it was not the intent of the sponsor to point fingers, but just have a good government bill before you here today.
Thank you, Mr. Stancliffe. So Representative Gruenberg's already heard this bill.
Good.
Just
Representative Coghill.
Just to note that the senator has intent language in his bill. It's interesting. He's the one that would like to scrub most intent language, I think.
He's your senator. You go talk to him.
Okay. Is there anybody? There isn't. I don't have anybody signed up to testify on Senate Bill 36. Is there anybody? Or online? Okay. So public testimony is in fact closed. That brings the bill back before us for committee discussion. We have one amendment.
I'm not going to offer it, Madam Chair. Just a couple things.
Okay.
Yeah, the amendment is the one we've been talking about on the House floor today, and I'm going to see how it turns out on the House floor, and maybe I'll offer it on the floor, but it's the issue of whether a party should be able to pre-mark somebody's party affiliation on an application, and we'll see what happens tomorrow. And if we have to deal with the issue again, we'll just deal with it on the floor. I'm a little concerned about some of the language in here. Just if you look, page 2, line 8, no, page 2, line 7, and just let me know if I'm wrong about this. I certainly have no problem with this whole underlying concept that you send the absentee ballot applications straight to the Division of Elections. That's how I've always done it. But it says the voter shall submit. But all of us and anybody in the state can be a registrar. We can register people to vote. We can register them to get an absentee ballot application if you...
Absolutely.
And I want to make sure that those people can also do that, because it seems like this becomes a crime if somebody other than the voter sends it in. So what does that mean, the voter has to do it?
Madam Chairman, that's an excellent question. It did come up early in the process, and we had testimony in the other body from the Division of Elections that if you are a registrar or you are officially recognized, you are, in fact, the Division of Elections as far as they are concerned and this bill would be concerned. So if you receive something from the voter, you have been authorized on behalf of the division. When you undertake that activity, it would not be a problem.
Is voter defined in the law somewhere? Or I know that nobody at the Division of Elections would go after you for this, but is voter defined in the law somewhere as also including a registrar, or do we have to put that in somewhere?
You know, I'm not 100% sure on that. I know that this question did come up, and unfortunately, we don't have our division director here with us today. But I know that it was addressed before this gets any further in terms of floor action. We could discover and take that up with you, Representative Guerra.
Representative
Guerra? What I would like to do is, when the appropriate time comes, say the voter or authorized representative. As an amendment, but make it conceptual so that if the bill drafter determines that that's not needed, then they don't have to put the words in. But authorized representative would be anybody who's allowed to under the law, and that it seems like that would be a registrar.
Madam Chairman, one of the things that this bill does, if you'll notice in the early sections, is it instructs, and the division is going to be developing regulations to implement all this. And it's good that this is on the record, and I'm sure they're going to include that type of thing in their regulations. It's a policy call whether that's going to be satisfactory to satisfy this committee or the members.
Chair. I've thought about this more.
Representative Guerra?
Yeah. It just talks about friends, but it doesn't talk about registrars in the intent section. So I think when the appropriate time comes, I'm going to change it to voter, registrar, or authorized representative. Then if we find out that's not needed, then we can take it out.
Okay, Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at Catherine Kurtz's memo of March 17 okay. here. I don't recall that I did see this memo before, and as you can see, she recommends that as a matter of good drafting and in accord with the legislative drafting manual, that we put the language in the intent section in Section 1 actually into the bill itself, and that would eliminate the intent section, but it would be in the text of the bill itself. I think that her point is well taken, and I'm wondering through the chair if Mr. Stancliffe, you would have any objection if we were to do that. Oh, you right. haven't seen that.
Madam Chair, knowing my my boss's position on intent language, this would probably, he'd find this unobjectionable if that would be the wish of the committee.
So I would, I do respect Ms. Kurtz, she's a very good attorney, and I would just do a conceptual amendment that would adopt her suggestion so that the language, the relevant language in Section 1 would go into Section 2. That would eliminate Section 1, and I would ask that the staff work with Mr. Stancliffe and the folks in Senator Terrio's office to make certain that that's accomplished so that they don't do any violence. We worked a lot on the intent language in state affairs, and so this will put it in the text of the bill, and that's my motion.
So amendment number one, is there an objection to that motion? Amendment, pardon me? Okay, hearing none, amendment number one carries. Any further amendments to Senate Bill number 36? Representative Guerra.
I have two quick ones. I'm going to move amendment number two, which will be on page 2, line 7, it should be, instead of the voter, it shall be the voter, comma, registrar, or authorized representative. Leave the rest of the language the same.
I'll object to hear Mr. Stancliffe.
Madam Chairman, I believe that the registrar might be acceptable. Authorized representative gets into an area beyond that, and I know that the sponsor of the bill would be uncomfortable with that term. I believe that as long as you're officially recognized by the Division of Elections, that the amendment wouldn't be necessary to cover registrar. But if you were to entertain the motion and accept that amendment, it should not include, in my opinion, other representative.
Madam Chair, with the intent language, I think that also makes it clear. So I'll just do, I'll withdraw amendment number two and introduce a new amendment number two, which would just be the voter or registrar.
Madam Chairman, that's certainly acceptable, and it makes it plain, and I see that it doesn't do anything any damage to the bill at all.
Is there any objection to amendment number two, adding registrar? Okay, hearing none, amendment number two carries. Any further amendments to Senate Bill 36, Representative Guerra?
Chair, I don't know that I agree with Section 3, which says that in order for somebody's ballot to, in order for somebody to get an absentee ballot, you're changing it so that they have to send that in and get it to the division elections 10 days before the election instead of 7. And I guess I don't want to make it harder for people to get an absentee ballot. So I would move to Section 3 and leave the law the way it is, 7 days instead of 10 days.
Madam Chair, that was put in at the bequest of, excuse me, at the bequest of the division, and because of the increase in votes, because of the activity of people weighing in to on both sides of the party equation, to the volume, the sheer volume, this enables the division the time it needs to fully process and get the paperwork done. The sponsor could see that argument quite clearly with the statistics that they delivered after last year. It's a policy call whether you want them to have more part-time people and all work 24 hours a day, or that you want to give them additional time so that everybody who wants to vote gets a chance to vote, because quite frankly, last year they were totally overwhelmed.
Representative Coghill?
I'm going to object, because I think we have softened the laws significantly under early voting, and we have given a lot of latitude even for giving notices out and applications out. So we have stretched out our voting season significantly. And I think because we've given latitude on that end, trying to get them in, because we do now, what we're doing is I know we're counting one day's vote, but we've allowed a huge latitude in all those applications, and there's a lot of paper moving from the beginning of the time that you can make that application. So I think putting a tighter or a closer line on it so that they're fairly treated, because really that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to say if we're setting up an earlier deadline, it's for your fairness. It's not to exclude you, but it's to make sure that everybody's dealt with properly. And to put stress under the Division of Elections isn't going to help. It's not going to hurt to move up 3 days and say, since we've softened up the application process by weeks. So I think I'm game to putting it at 10 days.
Further discussion? Ms. Glazier, would you like to comment? This is an amendment by Representative Guerra to remove Section 3 to allow the law to stay the way it is now at 7 days.
Madam Chairman, Laura Glazier, Director of the Division of Elections. We asked Senator Terrio to extend that to 10 days. We did see an overwhelming response and interest in voting by absentee this year, as you could tell by our elections bill and all the discussions I'm sure you've had with constituents. When you have a 7 day out, that means that we can receive an application up to 7 days. If that application is received in a regional office, that means it has to be checked in there. Again, this is about the integrity of the election. Then it gets DHL'd into the Juneau office, where we do the processing and the absentee ballots, or that was the process in 2004 and historically in the years prior. So then you're 2 or 3 days in before you're actually doing the data entry and checking everything, and then the ballot needs to be prepared and mailed out. Your success rate, or the ratio of voters who actually receive a ballot at 7 days out, especially when you get a major influx right at the end, you're setting the state up for failure and the voters to not receive a ballot. And so our interest was to ensure that a voter get a ballot. When we say 10 days out, I have to tell you, you know, the people that were working this process, you know, the temporaries and our staff that have been with the division for many years prior to me being there, all said 2 weeks. I mean, this was the lieutenant governor said that's too far out, and the compromise was 10 days. We do have early voting in the state 15 days prior to an election. You can go to any regional office. You can, so if in fact you are called out of state or you need to leave, you can go to that or to an early voting site and pick up a ballot and cast your vote. So there are many opportunities in our state to vote, and I think this is the best way to ensure that a by-mail application is available. We also allow by-fax voting, and that starts 15 days out. So you can put your application in and get your ballot back and complete the process all still before the 10 days. So that's why I would like to have it be 10 days.
Also going down the road of scanning. So, and I think all those things, scanning. So I think, but Madam Chair, one of the reasons why I think, in fairness to the voter, we have a lot of military folks here, and they don't get the opportunity to do the early voting because quite often they're on temporary duty. And so, and in my district, I had Fort Wainwright and I had Eielson. And so I have huge amounts of people, and I'm working overtime to make sure that they get information and applications way in advance of their time to do it. But I'm under a timeline, too. I can only start doing that at a certain time. And so if they get their ballot the day after the election, they may just go, what's the use? And so I think that's one of the reasons why I'm in favor of scooting it this way, so that we include more people or they don't feel disenfranchised. I mean, because they can still vote.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
I think you want to, I think it's exactly the opposite. What this does, this is going, with all due respect, there are two groups that'll be affected if we move it out 10 days, the additional 3 days. Group number one is the military. People who are overseas may lose the opportunity to vote if we do this. The second group, if we move it out, is the people who are shut-ins and at home and don't have the fax machines, the older people who mail their stuff in because they can't get out to the polls. But primarily, I think, military. We should allow them to submit their application up to a week, and not cut them off. It may be very difficult for them to get the thing back in, but at least give them the chance to do so. I've got military in my district, the people who live just outside the main gate, and I think it's very important we give them the opportunity to vote. Those 3 days could be really important. I'm sorry, it may be difficult, but
okay, there's an objection. Madam Secretary, will you call the roll on amendment number 3?
Madam Chair?
Representative Gruenberg?
Yes, I just want to be sure there's nobody else who has anything to say about this.
Anybody else have anything to say about it?
Well, he makes a good point. Because I do have a lot of military guys, I might have talked myself right into his argument. And that is, we have a lot of APO guys that are going to get it. And maybe I should ask Ms. Glazer then, what happens to an APO address if it comes in on the, if we keep it 10 days and it comes in on the ninth day?
Ms. Glazer?
I'm Representative Coghill through the chair. So you're asking if the, right now, the timeline, the marker is 7 days out, if it were 10 days, but the application was received 9 days out, would we process it? The answer would be no, just like now if it comes in 6 days prior.
Madam Chair.
Representative Crockett.
I guess my concern was that their vote would be not counted. But if they don't
get the application.
But there's no, yeah. And I was going back on the other end. We have allowed earlier and earlier application of absentee votes, and I take that very seriously. And I go as soon as the day says you can do that, I send them a notice saying, you know, you can do this. You know, here's your application, because I want to make sure they understand I'm interested in their vote.
So
maybe Ms. Glazer could help us with a timeline on that, because I think it'll make a big difference on it to me how I view this. They might actually get me on this one, even though it's a tension on the department. I'm interested in the department being able to properly handle them. And last year was, I guess, the bumper crop on absentee applications. But Ms. Glazer, why don't you give us a little timeline at this point, as the law is, on what when we can actually start sending out applications, or when an application can actually be sent in to you.
Representative Coghill through the chair, I'm looking for the statutory site, but my recollection is it's January 1st of the election year. And that's why when you say that you're concerned about military voters and shut-ins have special needs voting afforded to them. But additionally, in the military, they have voting officers in the units that are, I mean, that's their job and their charge to make sure the people are aware and what the timelines are. They also have their own application. They become UOCAVA voters, and they can vote just for president or just for the U.S. Senate. the military voters have, I would almost say, extra attention because they have their own voting officers who are encouraging them to participate and to be aware of, you know, when they're shipping out and when they're not. We had a request this last year through the Lieutenant Governor's office to set up early voting sites. I believe it was in Elmendorf. I'm not sure the other base that we did it on, but we did it just for a few days prior to deployment so that they could come in. We had all 40 ballots available, and the men and women in the armed forces could get a ballot. So we did extend those services at a time of war to those people who needed it. But with the, I mean, the application process isn't so narrow that if you chose to vote by mail. And again, I don't recall the figure, but I think we were getting 2,000 and 3,000 applications 8 days out. I mean, so there were people waiting till the last minute to apply. Now, I understand they have the freedom to do that and under the law, and so we worked with everything we had, but, you know, it's a human process. There were also people who we took it all the way, and they didn't receive their ballots, and that breaks my heart. I mean, there were people that cried, that stayed and worked all night to get those ballots out. So whatever we can do, it's not just that an application is processed, it's that somebody actually has the opportunity to vote.
Yeah. That's the point that I was trying to make. Wait, excuse me, Representative Coghill. That's the point that I was trying to make earlier, was that, you know, I mean, it's needs and wants. And the problem is that if a person never gets their ballot, they don't get the opportunity to vote. And in the case of the military or people overseas, it's even more important because these ballots have to then go, in many cases, you know, obviously airmail. You know, I have a friend that lives in England, and she doesn't get mail from me for, you know, 10 days when I mail it. So, Representative Coghill.
And that, I guess my original point was that those votes actually get a chance to be processed. And so maybe the question should be, at what point do you quit? As you said, you had a deadline. So why don't you explain to us what happens when the clock goes ding? When is that? That you cannot send any more out?
Well, Representative Coghill, through the chair, you know, we tried to do that, get those at the furthest point out the earliest. And so, 'cause you're basically gambling with U.S. mail, you know, how can you ensure the most? I believe our last date out this year was, if it wasn't the 28th, it was the 29th of October. So we took it to, you know, a handful of days prior to the election. And I know we got complaints. I'm sure you all read the newspaper articles. We got blasted for not delivering. And I had more people on 17 people crammed in that space doing data entry all night, all day and all night. So we were doing everything that we could to stay on top of the workload, again, because ensuring that people get their ballots is the most important thing that we do.
Just to press the issue on, is the day of the election the deadline that, I mean, when is that point when you will not send out another application?
Representative Coghill, through the chair, when it starts getting close, because we had, you know, we were getting all those ballots in late, we also had the problems with the D applications. We had a lot more personal contact with the voters. We set up an 800 line. We were calling people back and saying, you know, your application wasn't completed properly. How can we help you? We were facilitating fax voting. So when it got in close to those days, when we started thinking you're not going to get a ballot in Florida, then we were calling the voters. That's why we had people there at all different hours trying to call people on the East Coast overseas. I know our election coordinators on the phone with people in Italy and trying to figure out, okay, how can I fax you your ballot? Because that's the only way I'm going to ensure that you will get this ballot. So, you know, we were undoing, you know, everything that we could. You know, we all chipped in and...
Yeah, this is, as I understand it, you can vote up to midnight on election day, 11:59 p.m. This is the time by which they must have received your application for an absentee. And under current law, they've got to send you a ballot if they've received your request for a ballot, your application, 7 days before. This would make it 3 days earlier. And from what I understood Ms. Glazer to say, that would cut off at least 3,000 people.
But I apologize to start losing my cool here, but it's 3:25 and we've gone round and round and round. The fundamental premise or point is that you have the director of the Division of Elections telling you how it works in practicality. So we can sit here in our idealistic world and speculate all day long about what we would love to have happen. But in reality, no matter when you put your application in, you have to have received your ballot in time of election day to vote. And if you don't have your ballot, your vote doesn't count. So what she's saying is it's misleading, at best, to say to voters in my district and yours and others, go ahead, you've got till 7 days before, send in your application for a ballot, but you may never get it in time. And so what you're hearing her saying is, I can tell you that at 10 days, I have the better likelihood of fulfilling the expectations of your constituents. So we're asking them to make the sacrifice of 3 days to pay attention to the date, to move it up, in exchange for the greater good of all the individuals that are applying getting the opportunity to vote. So, and I'm sorry to get frustrated, but we've gone round and round and round on this, and I'm ready. With all due respect, is there a way we could take a vote on the amendment?
Could I just say one thing?
Representative Gruenberg.
You're right, Madam Chair, that it may very well be that they wouldn't get their ballot in time. On the other hand, there may be people just outside the gates of the post, very close, who would get the ballot in time.
And I think you're always going to have that, no matter where you put the deadline. I think you probably have people right now that are at 6 days and 59, you know. And so, okay,
Madam Chair,
vote. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. And I'm sorry this is going to frustrate you. I've listened to the discussion on what was a simple amendment go all over the place, and the one question we didn't answer, and I'll withdraw the amendment if I don't get the right answer. I don't want to create a false expectation either, but if we make this back to 7 days, which I would like to, I guess if you tell me the division's not going to hire any staff and so therefore what Representative McGuire says will happen, then I guess I'm frustrated and I guess I won't offer the amendment because it's not going to help anybody. But if we go back to 7 days, I'm hoping you tell me that you would hire the extra staff so that we could process the applications. And I guess so the fate of the amendment, I guess, depends on and I know it's not you, it's the division, but I guess could you let us know if we move it back to 7 days, would the division be able to hire the staff so they could get those applications out in time?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, we don't have the power of appropriation. If we have the funding, we would hire the staff. Nobody expected 100% increase, 130%, a 13,000% increase in federal overseas ballots. I mean, there was no manager in any state that was prepared for what happened in this last election cycle. And the reason I asked Senator Terrio to extend this to 10 days was to ensure that more ballots got out. We're still looking in an organizational structure of how to improve the absentee. It has never been addressed in any year prior to me being the director as far as planning for growth. There'd been no planning in the division as far as space needs, employment needs. That had not occurred, and that's where I'm trying to go. So if the question is, did you learn anything from 2000? And my answer is yes, I did. And I'd still stand by my request for 10 days and believe, if I thought it was hurting voters, I could not sit here and ask for 10 days. I believe this is going to ensure that the most voters get their ballots. And to me, disenfranchisement isn't that you have more days, it's that you have the opportunity to vote and that your vote is counted. And that's why I'm asking for 10 days. But it's a policy call.
I'm going to leave the amendment. I'm going to ask for a vote, and I think if we pass it, I think it's our job to give them the funding for the staff so they can actually process the application. 7 or 10 days, it sounds like we haven't been giving them enough. So
I won't refer to any recent amendments on the floor to reduce their funding even further by members of your party.
I didn't vote for it, Madam Chair, but I appreciate your memory.
Madam Secretary, will you call the roll on amendment number 3?
Representative McGuire.
No.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Coghill.
No.
Representative Cott.
No.
Representative Dahlstrom. Representative Bloomberg.
Yes.
Representative
Buehr.
Yes.
2 yes, 5 no.
Okay. And so that brings the bill back before us. Are there any further amendments, any further discussion? Okay. And is there a motion to move it out? Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the House CS for Senate Bill 36, version F, with attached to call note and individual individual recommendation.
Okay, and so as amended, there were 2 amendments, right?
I think one's on about 3.
So there was at least one. Okay, so is there any objection to that motion? Okay, hearing none, Senate Bill 36 is moved. And Mr. Sandcliffe, we are losing our quorum here. I'm going to leave it up to you to decide whether you want to bring it up right now, at least start the testimony. Do you want to wait? Representative Anderson has Labor and Commerce to chair, and Representative Cott goes with him, and Representative Dahlstrom has a meeting.
Madam Chair, I think that all those duties are more important than taking up this particular resolution at this time.
Okay, so we will take it up. I understand you have a time crunch, so we will take it up very first up on Monday, or it's your choice that we could take it up Friday with somebody else presenting it.
Monday will be fine.
Very first up on Monday at 1 o'clock. Appreciate your patience. I'm going to go ahead and recess to the call of the chair, not for anything unseemly, just because I don't know what's going to happen on Friday or anything when we'll get a chance to meet. So I'm going to recess to the call of the chair.